September has arrived, cooler prevails. To me, it's like going to a spa. Life seems to offer fewer travails, and the word of the day is ah. Ah, yes. This is where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin congregates and communicates. Thanks for finding a place in the audience. I'm Al Ross. This week, Catherine Thomas and James Leary talk about his book on folk songs found in our neck of the woods. We had some colorful characters, and hopefully still do. Author Nicholas Butler offers a tribute to the late poet Brian Bearhart. The member spotlight from the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson is a video this year, and as most things Phipps, not a beat was skipped. The annual and popular Scrabble Bee from Literacy Chippewa Valley is virtual this year. We have those details. And here is our commencing conversation. Music therapy, a combination of things artistic, psychological, and scientific. We're in a time of historic value where coping is a bit different than we've known or ever expected. As I'm sure you have, I've read a lot about how people are getting through it all, and others are devising ways to help the process. Music therapy is established and effective for a lot of people and their situations. To talk more about the specialty, I found the Music Therapist Company in Altoona, Wisconsin, and contacted therapist Sheila Wall. From your website, I'm going to read something. Music holds such power. It can unlock old memories and create new ones. It can unite strangers in song. It is the soundtrack of our lives. Music is also a remarkable tool that can stimulate the brain, develop new neural pathways, and spur physical development. And through music therapy, music slows the effects of dementia, assists developmentally disabled children, learn to communicate, and helps adolescents learn coping skills. Now, the last three words of that definition that I believe we'll eventually focus on here, and I'll explain why in a moment. But first, if you would please, Sheila, give our audience a thumbnail look at music therapy. It hasn't been around forever, has it?
Music therapy has been around since people have been around, but as a formal, recognized therapeutic intervention, such as occupational therapy, physical therapy, that category of a therapy started in the mid-50s. There were nuns that started doing music and then found the therapeutic purposes for it and were using it in their nursing homes. And then the studies began and they started researching and it developed more and more and more. And until the therapeutic view of what it does in the brain could be measured, you know, it was difficult to see inside the brain as to what was happening before technology caught up. Mm-hmm. And now, with the technology the way it is more possible to see. There were lots and lots of studies done with biofeedback machines and those kinds of things to see people were actually responding in a comatose state to the music, and they could measure that via biofeedback machine. But to actually watch what's happening inside the brain is a very recent studies that are being done now because of the technology that's available to us that wasn't available before.
I'm guessing that music has been in your life a long time, personally, and now professionally, and sometime back when the light bulb went on that illuminated a way that the two of you, Sheila and music, could work together to make lives better.
Yes. My mother was a music teacher, an elementary music school teacher. I've been around music my whole life. I started college as a music educator. I thought that's all I could do. And I got married, moved to Eau Claire, started school there, and I didn't like music education. It wasn't quite the right fit. I didn't know what to do. As I was walking up the hall in the Haas Fine Arts Center, mm-hmm. I saw at the end of the hall a thing called music therapy. I said, music therapy? What is that? Knocked on the door of one of the teachers and said, what is this? And he told me, and I said, can I do that? And he said, sure. So I finished my education, and the rest is history. I've been doing music therapy since the late 80s.
Let's go back to that website definition. Although your description pinpoints adolescent coping skills, I believe people of all ages are using music during a time in America's history when coping isn't as easy as it once was. I should point out the impetus behind talking about this came from a Time magazine article that I was reading in one of the sections about music and the lack of sleep. One of the chapters quotes someone from the American Music Therapy Association. So then I searched a little bit, found you. The article, as I said, hones in on the inability to sleep well and music's potential there. That senior advisor that I alluded to talks about music playing a crucial role in, quote, quelling racing thoughts and establishing routines. It seems we have a parasympathetic nervous system. We've seen TV commercials for an app called Calm, which helps people relax. We can talk about everything you do as far as music therapy and who you work with, but how much of what I just set up there is part of what you can do?
Music is a universal therapeutic tool to bring about positive, non-musical changes regardless of the situation. So a person, if they're interested in improving their sleep, learning about how to manipulate music in their routine at night, and to some people, silence is music. What is happening in our culture, especially here, is the screen time. Everybody has their devices on, they have their TVs on, they don't pay attention to their environment typically. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, I don't listen to it, it's just background. No, your brain hears it. It hears it all. And your subconscious mind hears it all. Your conscious awareness may not be focusing on it because we have a thing called the reticular activating system where we focus on a specific thing. It allows us to hear our name from across a busy room, for example. We could go on and on. Our brains are designed to focus in on what we want to focus on.
Uh-huh.
So when you have distraction upon distraction upon distraction, the brain struggles with what do I focus on. We think that we've got this all under control, but we really don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the subconscious is so active in trying to figure out how do I sort this plethora of information. So mindfully using music as a tool to bring the brain into order is a very important skill to develop.
Uh-huh. We won't have time to cover everything, so I suggest that people go to websites like yours, and we'll give that address when we're finished yakking here. But on that website, you have questions and answers like what is music therapy, examples of changes we've seen through music therapy, and who can benefit from music therapy. Three big questions, and you provide the answers to them. Sheila Wall is with us, our guest on the phone, proprietor and a therapist at the Music Therapist Company that's located in Altoona. The need and the call for these kinds of things has increased since March when the pandemic took over our lives. Has it affected what you do?
Yes, it has. Most people don't understand the power of the music to help the body come into regulation. I've been able to do virtual music therapy sessions with folks who are not able to get out of their home or that are not comfortable being on a face-to-face situation, and I am able to see folks face-to-face with masks if they care to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I see kiddos that are not able to do face-to-face with masks if they don't want to do that. Their parents and everybody are very comfortable being here without a mask. My clinic is quite isolated, so it's been just me and the child or me and the child and the family. I also do in-home therapy with folks if that's something that they would like to do. But music is such a universal tool. It's very helpful that I sometimes will talk with the families over the phone and we talk about what they can be doing in their own home without necessarily a whole lot of intervention in some cases.
Can you quickly describe the process? I mean, you are called and you then what? You assess the person who is going to be your subject and then after that assessment you decide what kind of music and what kind of sessions are best?
I spend an hour with the potential client to see if it's a good fit, because sometimes it's not. The next session, if we decide it's something we go forward with, we do an assessment session. And then the next session after that, we develop the treatment plan. And then we go from there, the frequency of the treatments and whatever.
We've had Kathy Wrights on the program, conductor and director of the Stand in the Light Memory Choir. Turns out you're on the advisory board?
I am the president of the board for the nonprofit.
Okay.
It's been a very exciting process. We are moving forward with that organization as well, being very therapeutic for those folks who are shut in. Their caregivers then are able to go ahead and come into the virtual choir. Kathy has been very, very creative in developing the program and making sure that everybody can be involved. We send out about 80 invites every week, and it's been really, really very fun. We actually get out breakout rooms and do parts and the whole thing.
Pretty stunning results.
There are people that have expressive aphasia, for example, where they cannot speak words necessarily, but they can sing the words. They cannot maybe understand 100%, but they know what the song is about because music activates the entire brain.
This is a broad question, I'm sure, but who might need music therapy?
Well, depends on what the goal is. What is your goal? Because I know I have people say, well, it's only a person that has a mental illness or a person who has trauma. We can all benefit from understanding what music therapy does. All of us, I know I use music therapy on myself. You know, if I'm having a rough day, I will pick music mindfully to help change the mood. Or if I want to get up and just clean my house, for example, I pick out my happy songs as loud as I can make it play without disturbing the neighbors. Then I get the motivation and off I go. And you see people, you know, having music while they're exercising or music while they're, you know, driving, drumming on the steering wheel. And some people will, you know, will sing with their windows shut, singing in the shower or whatever. So it's such an integral part of all of our lives that it's just really important to be able to understand how to mindfully manipulate that for ourselves.
Well, it's fairly well documented how much music can move you. A sad moment in a motion picture.
Can you imagine having that sad moment without music?
There probably
or an exciting, you know, a fight scene?
Yes.
No music.
Yeah,
let's try that.
That's pretty cool. Music and art therapy, do they work together?
Yes. Music therapy can be used with most other therapies. We like to collaborate a lot. We collaborate with each other. There's another music therapy company in Eau Claire. We are very good friends, and we have very different approaches. She has different background, and we just collaborate a lot. We will refer people back and forth.
People, their appetites have been whetted. How do they get more information on you and the philosophy of music therapy?
Well, they could come to my website, which is musictherapist.co, not .com, .co, or they can Google music therapy. They will get to the American Music Therapy Association's website. There are lots and lots of resources.
Sheila Wall, thank you so much.
You're welcome. You have a great day.
Ever heard of Otto Rindlisbacher? You can answer yes after today. We're missing a poet and a FIPS members show their stuff. Coming up on Spectrum West, for now, literacy Chippewa Valley depends on a lot to maintain its viability, and one is the annual Scrabble Bee. This year is the 19th, and you may have guessed it's going to be a bit different this year. To find out how different, I contacted director Liz Hart. And you've had it at various locations, haven't you? You moved it around a little bit just out of necessity as it got bigger?
Yes. Originally, or at some point, it was up at 29 Pines. And then we had it several years at the New Lismore. And last year we had it at the Pablo Center. And this year I think it's a venue that everyone's going to recognize. Your homes.
Yeah, that's true. You've already set that up. It's virtual this year.
It's virtual this year, out of necessity.
So talk about the adjustments that you've had to make.
Well, we have a lot of programmed material. Some will be live and some will be pre-recorded. Various speakers. We have students and our board members and tutors. John Murphy from 98.1 will be the celebrity MC.
Cool.
So there is some programming to watch and to learn about Literacy Chippewa Valley and just join together with other supporters of the organization. And then we will have a real-time live game. So if you plan on participating, we will have you register in advance for a special site. It's called the Internet Scrabble Club. People will play a game of Scrabble. It's different this year in that there's no hare division. It's all tortoise. So you'll be playing against your own teammates, but then we'll have a collective score for the team. And then the scores will be compared to the other scores. So there will be team prizes as well as an individual high score.
Okay.
But you will be playing with your teammates. The teams are reduced to 4 members instead of 6. If you don't have a 4-member team, then you can register as an individual, and we will put you on a team with other participants in the event. So everybody will play one game, and I think it'll be interesting. I think it'll be a lot of fun. And then simultaneously, or actually in advance, we will have a fabulous silent auction. And people can start bidding up the items, I think, as early as Tuesday. The bidding will go from Tuesday through Thursday and then stop at 8 p.m. And then we will announce the winners. We have really lovely items. I think over almost 30 organizations, businesses have donated things for this auction. So there's some nice stuff.
You kind of said it at the beginning of the description you just gave us, but how are things set up technically? What's the system for participating? Is it a link? Do they need an app? What happens?
Yes. The actual platform for the event will be, it's a Google app. So
okay.
We'll send you that link to watch the event, and then the silent auction will be on a different link. So if you're savvy, you can have 2 things open at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Scrabble Bee will be, again, on a 3rd link. All of these will be embedded so that people will have an easy time opening them up.
Okay.
There will be different links to get to the different things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm guessing that maybe new or seldom used words might show up this year, like pandemic and distance and symptom and global. Is PPE going to be acceptable? Is that a word?
Oh, that is a good question. Well, that's an abbreviation, so I don't think that we can have PPE.
It's been used so often like a word. I didn't know that there is a Merriam-Webster official Scrabble Players Dictionary. I looked that up.
Yes, there is. Yeah, there is. I mean, the people that designed the website that we're using, the International Scrabble Club, they are champions. They are world champions of Scrabble. They made up this site for people to play with other individuals from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great website. No advertising. It's just hardcore Scrabble players, people who are interested, and they're able to support all of our players.
Cool. Last week we had verbivore Richard Lederer on. He's the author of 52 books on words and the English language and stuff. So I'm guessing that maybe he and English teachers are banned.
Well, I don't know. We always respect your own Dean Kallenbach. He's a good player.
And is he? Yeah.
But since people will not be able to prefigure their words, you know, that's the way the hare version was, you were able to do that. This will be more the traditional tortoise version, where you have to think up the words based on the letters that you have in your tile holder.
Okay. All right, it's time to get to the nuts and bolts. So first of all, let's tell people how they can still get in, and then come at me with all the details, the date, the time.
Okay. Well, this is our virtual fundraiser, Scrabble Bee. It will be September 10th. The actual event will be from 7 o'clock p.m. to 8:30, but there will be advanced availability for the silent auction. And if you're interested, you can go to the website and register online. Otherwise, if you have a team, just email us and we'll send you all the stuff, because with a team, you'll probably have a team captain. There's a little bit of pre-work to do, just getting logged on to the International Scrabble Club site. Other than that, not too hard. The event is a little less expensive this year. We're charging individuals $25, and then a team of 4 would be $100, partly because we won't have a venue and there won't be any refreshments other than what you pull out of your refrigerator.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. No pizza.
If you don't like the refreshments, it's on you.
Right. We just really want to gather everybody together for our event. So it's a little bit pared down, but I think we still are maintaining the spirit and the intent of what we do.
What is the website?
The website is just literacychippewavalley.org.
Literacychippewavalley.org.
Yes.
And email is info@literacycv.org.
Yes.
Okay. So if you have questions, that's the place to go. And we did have questions, and we knew where to go, and that is Liz Hart. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Al, and we look forward to the WPR team.
So do we, and they better come back with some hardware.
Okay.
By the way, the registration deadline for Scrabble Bee is Monday. You're listening to Spectrum West on WPR. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us. The Phipps Center for the Arts has flourished and endured in Hudson because it has the best of what a regional arts center needs. Leadership with character, the right people in the right positions, a sound patron base, and those willing to volunteer their talent on its behalf. The Phipps has transitioned amazingly in the last few months. As if a pandemic wasn't enough, there was the retirement of an executive director who, over a trio of decades, took the Phipps to new levels of proficiency. And with the pandemic still hanging around, Phipps folks, both with a PH, of course, continue to find ways for it to be the place people expect and appreciate. Anastasia Sharton is director of visual arts. I called her the other day. You know, being the visual arts director has to be a little weird ever since March. Although, things can still be visual. Tell me about the challenges you've had to face with doors closed and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it really has been a challenge. You know, we have our programming planned out, you know, at least 2 years in advance, not you know, just in our galleries, but we do off-site exhibition programs at the Hudson Hospital and Westfield Hospital and two senior living centers.
Right,
we work with a lot of artists. We also do, you know, an annual art fair that brings 90 artists in. So we had a lot of artists lined up. There were so many unknowns back then. You know, we didn't know if this was going to be something just for a month that we were going to, you know, kind of have things closed, or was it going to be longer? I mean, all of those unknowns. We did, you know, close our doors, and we had an exhibition that was up at the time, so created a virtual tour of that exhibition to give the artists that exposure for all of the work that they had put into putting the exhibition up, and also being able to continue to fulfill our mission to bring arts to the communities. And then when we realized that we had to be closed much longer, each of the exhibitions that we had planned, we gave the artists then the opportunity to submit images of the work that they would have shown, and we did virtual exhibitions of that work. And then we also gave them exhibition opportunities at the end of our schedule. So in 2 years, they will get to show their work in the galleries. Something that I felt good about, giving artists that opportunity and such, but then also still giving them that exposure and giving you know, people stuck at home, the opportunity to still see the work of these artists. So we did that. We even, for our annual high school exhibition, we had the students submit their work digitally, and we got really good response on that. We still had it judged. We brought in two professional artists to judge that show, and we did a Zoom reception where the judges talked about their selections and answered questions from the students and such. So we've, you know, pretty much just been trying to do whatever we can in a virtual format. The other thing that we wanted was, you know, not only the opportunity to enjoy looking at original art, but also that hands-on experience. So we did a May Clay giveaway. The first 100 people to sign up, we gave them clay and made a little video tutorial on how to work with the clay, and then did a curbside pickup, and then scheduled a curbside drop-off. They dropped off their projects, and we did a clear glaze and a firing of them, and then a curbside pickup. So just, again, tried to find creative ways of keeping the arts in people's lives.
When I go to the Phipps Center, I keep seeing the four words, celebrate the creative spirit. It sounds like you guys have been really celebrating.
I mean, in these odd times, yes. So I have a group of artists that meet on an ongoing basis called What We Need Is Here. We have various topics or experiences that we do together, whether we, you know, go off-site or we bring speakers in or just, you know, we have the opportunity for them to share with one another, focusing on the role of art and sustainability, the role of art in society. That group initiated a journal-making project. So they distributed handmade journals and instructions on how people could make their own journals. Another, I think, innovative project, I guess, that we tried to do to celebrate the creative spirit as well.
That's impressive stuff. Way to go.
Thank you.
You guys. That's Anastasia Sharton. She is visual arts director at the Phipps Center in Hudson. To kind of recap, their virtual members spotlight, the video available on their website. Is the member spotlight an annual thing that you do, and you just did it on video this year, or was this something special?
It is an annual. For years, we had an annual members art exhibition. And then a handful of years ago, the Visual Arts Council said, you know what, we should really use this as an opportunity to showcase the FIPS overall. You know, the FIPS is a multidisciplinary arts organization, theater and dance and music. We opened this up when we were able to do it in person. We would have the opening event. We'd have like an open stage with musicians and comedians and storytellers. And in that spirit, we wanted this year to represent the FIPS, you know, overall. And so invited visual artists, but then, you know, artists working in the performing arts as well. Not only is the, you know, artwork fabulous, and there are 40 artists who participated, but we also had performing artists come and perform on our stage, videotape that, you know, with social distancing and proper protocol. Then we integrated that into the virtual exhibit so that as you're looking at visual art, you are hearing musicians and singers, and I just think the video turned out beautifully.
A young sax player and some modern dance, a guitar player, some unique art. I especially enjoyed the art with movable parts.
That's Joseph Haidt. We're reopening the galleries with an exhibition on September 11th, and he's featured in Gallery 1.
Well, you got that plug in. Good for you. How is the FIPS post-Potter?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, an end of an era, that's
no
for
kidding.
Sure. We really could not have been in better hands with John. His energy and tenacity stuck through to the very end. Huge credit for that, especially during these very strange times.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all just really grateful. Darby Lunsford, our new executive director, has just stepped in beautifully, bringing, you know, new energy and new focus, a real wealth of experience to the organization.
Great. Anastasia Sharton, visual arts director. The FIPS Center in Hudson, just one of many gems in the crown that is our artistic neighborhood in western Wisconsin. Thanks so much for being with us, and we will, as we always do with the FIPS, keep in touch.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Al. Have a great day.
Brian Bearhart was a poet. Now, as a poet, your words live on, so though he died last month at age 41, maybe it's Brian Bearhart is a poet. Sometimes known as B. William Bearhart, he's a direct descendant of the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin, a graduate of the MFA Creative Writing Program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. His work is found in Boston Review, North American Review, Prairie Schooner, Tupelo Quarterly, and more. With sadness, West Wisconsin author Nicholas Butler noted Bearhart's passing on Facebook. I called Nick for a verbal remembrance and a sample of his work.
Brian was just like a really good literary citizen in the area, at the very least. And he would come to all my readings, and I found out over time that he was driving down from Turtle Lake, where he worked as a dealer at a casino. And he was just a really talented poet. And it's really sad. He didn't have a book come out in his lifetime, but I wouldn't be surprised if somebody collects his poems and something gets published posthumously.
It would be nice to look into whether that's happening or not.
I have looked into it a little bit, and I'm not sure that I'm the person to carry the ball over the line.
Do you remember the first time you met him?
Well, I think it would have been at the Chippewa Falls Public Library. He was outgoing, shy but outgoing. When it came to literature, he wanted to make connections with other people, and that's where I met him first. So after that, I always made sure that if he was in the crowd that I talked to him. And mm-hmm. And it wasn't that long ago that he came over to my house. We were talking and kind of spent the morning drinking coffee. And it's just been really strange to consider that there won't be other times like that.
Poets do a wonderful job of interpreting their work vocally. Did you ever hear him do that of his work?
No, I didn't. And that's one of the shames, too. I mean, we had talked about the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, maybe be like a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
When you read his poetry now, I mean, it's powerful stuff. It's very accomplished, and it feels like of our place on the planet. Yeah, the whole situation's real sad.
So how was his work shared with you?
I've seen a lot of people circulating his poems around social media, so I know he's being read now, and I know that like a generation of younger poets, even though he didn't have a book out, were sort of waiting for that.
Mm-hmm.
The more we became acquainted, the more I would look into his work, but I'm just glad to see it's being read now.
Did his work have a certain kind of mood, or did he write about kinds of things, or was he all over the board?
One thing that's quite hopeful is the poem that I'll read seems to me to be, and I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in either poetry or specifically his poems, but what I see is that it's a poem that feels like it's written by somebody from our part of the world who cares about the natural world, who can make the natural world magical. And I see that in some of his poems for sure. But there was also a tragic through line of, you know, feeling that his life was pretty fragile.
I think it's a wonderful time to dive into that piece you're going to read.
Okay. This poem is called Because I Don't Have Much But Canoe. A green crescent moon, no, I put it there for you. Watermelon cleaned of nectar, red flesh. White seed, stars spit into night. I have so many gifts, so many ways to convince you to stay. I won't get sick again. I give you constellations, I give you split moon, white belly sewn, a canoe to drift along your lips, mouth open, crest of valley, tongue of valley floor, sweet water flood, oh God, down the chin. Now gather five fingers and weave into fingers a handmade net, seed full night. Let's harvest and plant, sow into earth, belly full of lightning bugs, feel them grow into lightning bolts.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poem. It just, when you see it on paper, it's just got wonderful movement across the page. To me, it feels like this time of year, your heart is full of summer. Maybe your heart's a little broken because it's the end of summer. It reflects where we live. I'm a sucker for anything that mentions canoe.
And lots of imagery there, picturing what he was suggesting.
Yeah.
Is there a place that Brian Bearhart's work can be had?
Yes. I mean, it's easy enough to just sort of Google his name, Brian Bearhart, or B. William Bearhart. He also was going to be part of a Norton project, the Norton anthology called When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, edited by Joy Harjo. I'm not sure when that's going to be published, but it's soon, and that would have been a major, major honor. He has some really beautiful poems on a website called Pank that I was looking at earlier, and also on the Rumpus. But, I mean, this is a guy who published extensively, published high-quality poems, and it's just, again, sad that he didn't get the recognition he deserved before he was gone, but hopefully people will be reading him now. Maybe somebody can get a book together to collect his poetry.
It's very inspiring the way you are holding on to his legacy and making sure that other people see it. I mean, he's a literary brother.
You know, I think one thing that I appreciate, to be real honest with you, Al, Brian was a First Nations person, and he saw opportunities and limitations in the literary community here, and he was trying to make it more diverse, and he would push me in that direction from time to time, too, which I appreciated. He had his own confidence and strength inside the literary world, and he wasn't just, like, a fan or somebody who was, I don't know. Mm-hmm. He wasn't content with the way things were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the fact that he's gone now means we have one less voice like that. And that's one thing that I think is really worthwhile about, you know, making sure that people find his work.
So those who may be riding in the same canoe can use his work and his life as an inspiration, and they may find inspiration and maybe even answers in what they read.
Yeah, I wish he was just around.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, offering fixed-rate mortgages, bridge loans, construction loans, and more. Loan officers Dawn and Susie are dedicated to providing personalized service. CharterBank.bank. Invested in partnerships. Oh, Catherine Thomas is here. She's combined her love of reading with her enjoyment of folk music, the history behind it, and the added delight of playing it. Her guest is UW Madison historian and author James P. Leary.
We're going to talk about Folk Songs of Another America.
Yeah.
No, it's been several years since it was published. It was 2015.
Correct.
But I just discovered it, and I'm sure some of our listeners, it will be new for them, too. So can you tell us what it is? Folk Songs of Another America, Field Recordings of the Upper Midwest, 1937 to 1946.
It's a compendium or a selection from a little under 200 songs and tunes that were recorded from more than 25 different cultural groups, linguistic groups in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota in the late 30s through the mid 40s. The ones in Folk Songs of Another America are culled from a larger corpus of almost 2,000 songs and tunes the three folklorists working for the Library of Congress recorded initially, and they were Sidney Robertson, Alan Lomax, who is, I suppose, the most famous of them all, and then a woman from the University of Wisconsin, Helene Stratman Thomas, and they each went into communities with portable disc cutting equipment and a big bulky microphone and blank discs and a stock and needles, and they made these amazing recordings. For decades, only the English language stuff was ever released, because dealing with Ho-Chunk or the Loish dialect of Scots Gaelic or Lithuanian or something was too much of a challenge for any researcher. But I was lucky, because of the digital age and being able to send things to people who were bilingual in those various languages and English, I could get transcriptions of lyrics and translations, and then put together the restored sound recordings. We had to clean up their sound and put them together with about 100 photos and many pages of so-called liner notes that I wrote from digging out background material on the performers and the songs and the tunes.
Right, and you were nominated for a Grammy Award for that, Best Album Notes.
I did get a nomination. There were five nominees in that category. I lost out to Joni Mitchell.
Oh, man. Well, that's pretty tough.
It was a thrill, nonetheless. I did get an award for the Association for Recorded Sound Collections, the top award for a folk music reissue. So that was more a jury of the peers, and I was happy with it.
Yeah, so the set, it includes five discs of music and a documentary, and then a book you were just talking about that has the pictures, biographical information, and then translations of the non-English songs. And it was so popular, it sold out. I think it's still sold out.
We raised a lot of money so we could subsidize the initial production costs and make it affordable to ordinary people. But we only did a run of about 2,000, and it sold out. And then we couldn't afford, we couldn't raise enough money to do another, five disc plus the film DVD edition. So what we did was, through the University of Wisconsin Press and the University of Wisconsin Library in Madison, put up all the tracks as free downloadable, and the film is up there free as well. It's called Folk Songs of Another America, and it's a digital collection. And then we issued a paperback version of the book, so all of the notes and photographs and the translations and lyrics and so forth are in that, but then the actual sound recordings are freely available online.
Yeah, that's through the UW Digital Collections, I think.
Yeah.
But I think maybe polka music could be the music people might think of first if they think of folk music of the Upper Midwest. But the songs in this collection are much more diverse. French, Canadian, Finnish, Ojibwe, African American, Welsh, lumberjack music, and a lot more. You have these three song catchers going out to people they don't know to find music. How did they find them, and how did they convince them that it was a good idea to let them record the music?
Really good question. The person who had their finger on the pulse the most was Helene Stratman Thomas. She herself was from Wisconsin. She was part Cornish. She grew up with Cornish singers, and there were Welsh singers around. She was also, part of her family were German. So she knew people right away, and she also taught students, some of whom were Austrian or Italian or Polish, and they had relatives or neighbors who were singers, so she used that method. She also wrote a lot of letters, and there were newspaper stories, and so sometimes people would contact her or offer tips. But the first person to get started was Sidney Robertson in the 1930s, and she was funded by the Farm Security Administration. Charles Seeger, father of the more famous Pete Seeger, headed up what was called the Special Skills Division, and he had a conviction that folk music, the music of the people, was something that the people needed to perform to raise their spirits during the Depression. It was also a good thing for the federal government to recognize the art of the people and to do some documentation. And so Sidney Robertson was actually situated in Wisconsin, also worked in Minnesota, and she worked with county agents, one of whom was a guy named L.G. Sorden up in Rhinelander, and he knew French-Canadian fiddlers and lumberjack singers, and this Sidney Robertson was just a kind of a plucky person as well, single woman. She'd go into kind of rough lumberjack towns and make inquiries about singers, and she found some. And then Alan Lomax, he wrote a lot of letters in advance and did a lot of looking into where particular ethnic groups were settled in the upper Midwest. So he kind of had a plan of attack, but then he just talked to a lot of people and got referrals, and all three of these folks were quite charming, and I think, you know, there were local musicians who were proud of their skills and valued within their community, and everything managed to work out in a kind of an amazing way.
So networking was just as important then as it might be now.
Yes, absolutely. It was a little tougher to pull off. You had to kind of rely on the postal service and also go to places and ask around. Yeah, you absolutely had to network.
One of the musicians that they found, and he was recorded by all three of them, which I think makes him unique among the musicians in this collection,
yep.
Otto Rindlisbacher of Rice Lake. And he was a man of many, as I like to say. He had a lot of different jobs. He made and played a lot of different instruments and a lot of different music, too. Can you tell us about Otto and his group, the Wisconsin Lumberjacks?
Yeah, Otto was really quite remarkable. He was born in 1895. His parents were of Swiss heritage mostly, and they moved around to different parts of the state, but by the time he was a young man or in his teens, they were in Rice Lake. He worked in various sawmills and a little bit in the woods and some as a cheesemaker, which is what his dad had done, but he was an amazingly talented musician. His mother's family had been active Swiss musicians in Emmental and Switzerland. So Otto was steeped in this Swiss music, playing tunes on the Schweitzer hand orgelie, a little button accordion. But in Rice Lake, there were people of a lot of different backgrounds. So there was an immigrant Norwegian named Torsten Skarning, who had even made 78 RPM recordings in Norway. And he toured around the region, and Otto played some with him, but there were also French Canadians and Ojibwe or French Indian fiddlers and other folks around, and Otto learned to play lumberjack tunes as well as Scandinavian and Swiss tunes. His wife Iva was also a fine musician. She played a number of stringed instruments, and in the 1920s, when Hawaiian music became popular with the lap steel guitar, she even taught Hawaiian music, and she and Otto performed with some traveling Hawaiians over WCCO radio in Minneapolis and on other regional stations. They were pretty amazing. I'd also opened a cafe and billiard parlor with two of his brothers during Prohibition, and then it became the Buckhorn Tavern, which was kind of a northern Wisconsin museum bar that was operated, you know, until his death, full of all kinds of curios, including his world's largest collection of odd lumber camp musical instruments that were arrayed on the wall behind the bar.
Did he make most of those?
He made a lot of them. He made, one might say, simple but really good-sounding cigar box fiddles. He also learned how to make the very ornate 8- or 9-stringed Norwegian hardanger fiddle with mother-of-pearl inlay and India ink kind of floral designs on it and a special scroll on it. Yes, he made fiddles and some kind of cigar box guitars as well.
He was a taxidermist, too, and can you really describe the buckhorn for us? Because I think it tells a lot about Otto's personality.
Oh, man, it was like a Ripley's Believe It or Not sort of a museum. It had Al Capone's bulletproof windshield in there, and it had standard taxidermy of various wildlife from the area, but also these kind of invented tall tail animals. There was a fur herring. There was the shovel-tailed snow snake, a sort of a flat-looking fish called the owl-eyed ripple skipper. There was a horned owl, like with antlers on it, kind of like a jackalope, a flying jackalope called the dingbat. And these were surrounded by a fox or a rabbit or something like that along the walls. They used to confuse tourists from Minneapolis or Chicago who would come up and think they were real.
Yeah, he sounds like a fun guy.
Yeah.
James P. Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison, joins us today. We're learning about Otto Rindlisbacher and the Wisconsin Lumberjacks. They were a musical group from Rice Lake, featured in Jim's Folk Songs of Another America, field recordings from the Upper Midwest, 1937 to 1946. Some of the recordings from Folk Songs of Another America were from the National Folk Festivals of 1937 and 1938. What kinds of songs and acts would Otto and the Wisconsin Lumberjacks perform at those festivals?
Well, they wanted to give a little showcase of some of the entertainment that went on in lumber camps. Saturday night was in the big camps was often a time when people would get together and entertain one another. There were a lot of Irish who worked in the woods, and they had that old tradition of the Cayley, and French Canadians had the VA the evening, and Norwegians were used to utebooking this kind of house. Masked house visiting in the winter. So these were all old rural and immigrant traditions where people would entertain one another. And same with Ojibwas or Anishinaabe telling stories in the wintertime. So what Otto and his fellow members of the Wisconsin Lumberjack tried to do was just to kind of recreate a taste of a Saturday night entertainment in the lumber camp. There were fiddle tunes, including on cigar box instruments. They did jig dancing. They sang some tragic as well as comic songs about the river drive or working in the woods. They played some Norwegian and some Swiss tunes, including with yodeling. They told dialect stories in French-Canadian and Swedish broken English voices, and they also blew the Gabriel or the dinner horn, the tin horn that would be used to call people to come and have a meal. And so they tried to convey that whole experience of Saturday night in the lumber camp.
Yeah, they must have been well received if they were invited back the next year in 1938.
Yeah, I think they were, and in fact, the National Folk Festival is still going today, and although Otto did not continue with the Wisconsin Lumberjacks, Ray Calkins, who'd been a key member, along with Earl Schwartztrauber from Ladysmith, and eventually Ray lived out his life in Chautauqua. Tech. They continued into the 50s, and I think maybe even as late as about 1960, they did Wisconsin Lumberjack performances at the National Folk Festival and also sometimes at county fairs. And some of Ray's Wisconsin Lumberjack instruments are in the Historical Society Museum in Ladysmith, and Otto's, a lot of them are at the Wisconsin Historical Society Museum in Madison.
Wow. So their legacy lives on. I was going to ask,
yeah.
Does it in Rice Lake? That's your hometown.
He's certainly well remembered there. Different people have some Buckhorn memorabilia from that tavern, but sadly, after he died, within a few years, most of the collection was sold off. You know, in retrospect, I think it would have been a great thing if someone in the city government or the Chamber of Commerce with some vision might have, you know, acquired some of those artifacts. There is a Lumbering Hall of Fame getting underway in Rice Lake, and I would assume Otto would be venerated in a way as part of that. But he's certainly remembered, but the physical evidence is largely scattered, unfortunately.
Well, he's also remembered, of course, in your work, Folk Songs of Another America.
That's right,
yeah. That's been a great introduction to him and many other musical people from Western Wisconsin specifically, but also from the state as a whole, Michigan and Minnesota.
You know, I'll add that thanks to one of his grandchildren, we've recently acquired short stories and musical manuscripts, and we have other recordings of Otto at the Mills Music Library at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And within the next couple of years, we'll also put up an Otto Rindlisbacher collection of additional materials. And there are younger folks playing his tunes and trying to keep them in circulation, so that's exciting.
Yeah, keep it going. Well, Jim, I appreciate your time, and I have the hard copy from the Rice Lake Library, so I've really enjoyed looking at the pictures and reading about Otto and upper Midwestern folk music. You know, we hear a lot about other regions of the country, but not as much about our region, but it's out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is, and it's really rich, and it deserves not only discovery, but renewed performance.
Folklorist James P. Leary has been telling us about Otto Rindlisbacher and the Wisconsin Lumberjacks of Rice Lake. They and many other musicians from our region are featured in Jim's Folk Songs of Another America, field recordings from the Upper Midwest, 1937 to 1946. And all of the music and the documentary film from that collection are available online through the University of Wisconsin Digital Collections.
Thank you, Catherine. Boy, we got to run. Getting late. Great show lined up for next week. Have a safe Labor Day weekend. Take good care of each other and do the best you can. Bye.